Thank you all so much for joining us this afternoon, and really excited to be in the space with you all, and just to share the next part of the afternoon with you. We're going to start, my name is Ashton, and this is Sebastian, and we're going to start with a little movement, actually. In this space, so I think we have enough room if we like have kind of a circle and we can spread out here because we're just going to stand up. So just spread out and as much as you can. We can just push the chairs back a little bit and just give yourself enough room so we can have some room.
Lose yourself to dance. Lose yourself to dance. I'm going.
thank you all for joining us together in that space for a minute. One of the things that feels like just really nice is just to take up space and to move in the space together and just be free to do that. And that's something that we're going to be talking about a little bit later. So thank you all for joining. We're just going to go around and do some just quick introductions. Everybody's getting there, catching their breath, and settling into your seats. Check everyone's comfortable. Just your name, and we'll do your pronouns. And where you're from? Let's do that. And it could be any, that question can take me in many different ways. Start. My name is Ashley. I'm from Miami, Florida. I live in Providence, Rhode Island. She, her, hers. And let's go this way.
Sure. I'm Tanner. I like they and them. And I'm from Atlanta, Georgia, but I live in Albuquerque now.
I'm Amy, and I live in Providence, Rhode Island. I'm from Boston, Massachusetts, and she, her, and hers.
I'm Aaliyah, she, her, hers. I'm originally from Switzerland by way of New York, now hailing from Fort Collins, Colorado.
I'm Christian, I'm from Greenville, Arkansas, and I'm over to Kaishi.
I'm Cliff, I'm originally from Washington, D.C. I live in Tijeras, which is in the East Mountains of Albuquerque.
Chris, originally from Southern California, living in Santa Fe now. Nina has.
I'm Nina, she, hers, and I'm from London, Santa Fe, and Chicago.
I'm David, he, him, born in Miami, raised in D.C., the suburb of D.C., lived in Bay, Santa Fe, and D.C.
Saying Maxine Green, some of you know.
whose work has been an inspiration for me, and I hope to share from her in a minute. But also Bill Strickland, who started the Master Craftsman's Guild of Pittsburgh. And it was his work, being a ceramicist, and opening the door in his home studio to some young men who were on the street and said, come in, I have something to show you. And together they formed the Master Craftsman's Guild. And that project was a real inspiration to me in starting the organization that we work in, Community Music Works. Very much that nature of invitation, as an artist in a community setting, I'd like to bring you into a practice that I'm talking about. So I just wanted to start by naming those folks. Today we're going to spend a little time with these ideas of emancipatory pedagogy and freedom and music learning. And I'm just going to give a short background on the organization and its work, and some of the ways that we've integrated questions of emancipatory pedagogy into our work over a 21-year history. And then we're going to focus in on some more current questions, and I would just say that this is a time that we have more questions than answers, but a set of current questions about how we're becoming even more focused on some of these issues. And then I'll turn it over to Ashley, who will share the body of thinking that she's doing. So that's just a quick structure, and then we'll save time for discussion. State in the union, but Providence has an outsized presence for being such a small state. This is the storefront of our organization, Community Music Works, operating as classical musicians out of a storefront in a community. And I'll just start by saying that in some ways, when Arlene asked us to come and present the session, one of the things she's really interested in about our work is the way we're playing with and playing a traditional art form against the backdrop or in conversation with the values of empathy, equity, and belonging that animate the USDAC. And I think a lot of what we want to focus on today are the places where there isn't perfect alignment between a traditional form like classical music and some of these values that we hold up and try to practice. So, initially for me, the response was, as a college student, how could I make my work as a performing musician? I play violin and viola, especially play viola, in the context of a community, animating questions of social justice and education while having a performing life that's deep and rich and satisfying. And so one of the metaphors for that engagement, similar to Bill Strickland's setup in Pittsburgh, was to rent a storefront and really have a group of musicians working, practicing, rehearsing, teaching in a way that was totally normalized and visible to young people and adults walking by. So we often think about the we try over the years to achieve the normalcy of there's the gas station and there's the diner and there's the string quartet and there's the pizza and there's the, just like how does that become part of the fabric of the neighborhood? And then specifically around the educational work, how does a music education look when it's informed by questions of reciprocity, questions of not especially hierarchical stance between learner and teacher, and yet there is this tradition that we practice. So this was a quote from Maxine Green that felt like a call to action for me in the beginning, and she says, I hope that there exists and that I can speak to a community of educators committed to emancipatory pedagogy, particularly in the humanities arts. When I was just starting to think about this work, that felt like, yeah, I'd like to be part of that community too. And Maxine Green was particularly interested in the intersections of education, the arts, and social change. And for her, it was a lot about that, the moment of clearing or opening or seeing things, as she says, seeing things as they could be otherwise. She really loved the power of an art, of a moment with art, or a moment of witnessing art that gets you to suddenly see a different perspective or a different vantage point on life than you normally have. So for us, it's taken the form of working with young people, about 150 young people doing free music instruction, violin, viola, and cello, some of them like Amy's son, 5 days a week, some in 2 or 3 days a week, doing performances both in our traditional concert venues and non-traditional ones like our storefront sidewalk here, or the neighborhood deli, or in the case of, this was a quartet of alumni, just doing it in front of the neighborhood street fruit cellar. And then the students are also engaged in longer term projects. In this case, one where we've come into this tradition of ending every year with a collective piece with all the students that plays on a theme that's important in our community. And this was an arrangement of a song of People United, which was written as an anthem of solidarity in Chile in the 70s, and has been sort of taken up as an anthem around the world, as may be familiar to you. But one of the things that I alluded to is, you know, we feel like there is something of a headwind when we're practicing classical music and committed to some of the traditions that go along with it, some of them very special, like the opportunity to have a deep apprentice relationship, one-on-one instruction with a teacher and student. In our case, sometimes that's 5, 10, could be 12 years. A young person might be working with the same teacher, or at least with the same group of teachers. So we think about the very special qualities of that environment, like the one-on-one instruction, like the opportunity to be working in this thing, this practice, the violin, the viola, the cello, that involves a kind of physical, athletic learning. It involves an intellectual learning. It involves an emotional learning as you're learning to connect your emotional experience with the music you're transmitting, and really overall a kind of a spiritual learning, which is you're forming a relationship with this instrument that's you're deeply connected with, and so those are the special qualities. And so we think at one level our work is about making sure that young people, particularly in a sort of mixed economic and in some cases distressed economic condition, have access to that special opportunity. And at the same time, the repertoire, the traditions come decidedly from a white and European context where young people may or may not see themselves connected with those traditions. So one of the questions that Ashley and I were talking about coming to today was about just how you continually evolve an educational practice so you're staying attuned to the questions. To share this Fourier quote, something you may have been familiar with from Pedagogy of the Oppressed, where he says the unfinished character of human beings and the transformational character of reality necessitate that education be an ongoing activity. And in the context of the chapter, it doesn't just mean that we always have to be involved in education, but we have to always be evolving what it is we're learning and teaching, right? Because reality is not fixed, therefore the thing that you teach can't be fixed because you're with people that in a dynamic situation and it has to constantly be updated. And so in that vein, over the last couple of years, I would say, it's been especially rich to kind of re-examine some of the things we're doing. I'm going to just share a few more images and then ask us to take on a question for this room. One of the Fourierian ideas that I think we
find especially rich and pertinent for our work is that idea of a student and teacher working side by side, right? That this is about co-creating an experience, and it talks a lot about the, you know, resisting the banking model of education, where the teacher has all of the goods and the learner has none of the goods, and it's just about imparting the knowledge, right? But rather recognizing a deeply reciprocal relationship between learner and teacher. So in that vein, I kind of love just this image of, in this case, this was a guest artist, Johnny Gandelsman, some of you may know, coming to work with our students and our teachers on a piece of music that was commissioned for us and for Johnny as a soloist, based in salsa music, with a visiting salsa band and band leader and violinist. And it was a sort of wonderful, reciprocal, multi-directional learning going on, especially as I was sitting with one of my students for whom salsa is a kind of home culture music, and for me it was a beach music, but learning the rhythms from the page was something comfortable to me and less comfortable for them, and just so the ways we were able to create a lot of multi-directional learning felt like an expression of that Freirean idea. Just love the picture. Everyone getting prepared together. I'll just share just another anecdote of people sort of stepping in and out of places they feel their comfort zone. We've done a series of concerts at this neighborhood taqueria, not far from our storefront, and at first it was a way of just playing with this disruptive idea of where classical music takes place, and the taqueria has a tagline they love, which is authentic Mexican cuisine for every comfort level, which means the white people might go just for their burrito and the sort of milk quantities, and the Mexicans might go for their tripe and for authentic Mexican food. And so we played with this idea and authentic classical music for every comfort level, and maybe fits with this. And so people who come and sort of encounter our concerts because they were just going to pick up food come in, or people come in for the music but aren't so familiar with the food. So there's sort of a kind of organic, everyone being partly in and not partly out of their comfort zone. And then we had a wonderful opportunity with Emmanuel Axe, who's a world traveling famous pianist, who came and we said, well, let's do a concert with Emmanuel Axe in the taqueria, which was far outside of his comfort zone, but you know, fun for all of us.
Playing
an electric keyboard. Which probably had never done, hold on. So I guess the prompt, maybe just to pause here for a minute, is really about, well, you know, sharing examples of the salsa violin concerto. That's actually an image of that performance. Some young people spontaneously dancing, another image that just says a lot, and love that image. But we also play music by Bach and by Beethoven, and our students will learn some of those pieces. So we play a lot with this question of not necessarily discarding the canonical music, though we're trying to rethink the traditions, but rather in what place does the canonical music have in our learning and our performance. So that connection to tradition and yet the recognizing its problems. So there's an idea that Edward Said talks about, cultural critic, literary critic, himself a lover of music, and started a wonderful musical project with Daniel Barenboim, bringing Israeli and Palestinian and Arab musicians together in an orchestra. But Said talks about this idea of counterpoint and conflicting narratives. And the example that, one of the examples he talks about is reading Camus. And reading Camus, on the one hand, for the existential philosophy, and on the other hand, seeing that the context of North Africa doesn't challenge the sort of colonial backdrop, and so there's this sort of nameless, faceless Arabs who are in the background of the story and saying, like, that's a problematic narrative that's also part of the movie. And so how do you wrestle with the philosophy which you admire and keep, and the context and sort of blindness which you need to sort of look at critically? And he uses a musical metaphor. He says these two narratives exist in counterpoint with each other, which in music just means you've got two voices and they're going along simultaneously, sometimes with consonants or harmony and sometimes with dissonance, but you just recognize there's two lines. And he said when we read literature, we have to bring forward this idea that these multiple narratives exist. So Ashley and I were just talking a little bit about that with regard to our practices in forwarding traditions and recognizing some of the problems. And did you want to add anything about some of the concepts?
Just thinking about how does that, if there's like a part of that that takes place within us, you know, if we think about like negative emotions or things that we're struggling with that we might push aside or feel like there's only certain spaces that those things come out or have space and be addressed. And just there's just a relationship to that, because we can do that in our society. You know, are there people that we don't want to see regularly that might be struggling or maybe not living in the same way that we are, that we sort of want to just push away and hide? And what would that be if we just were able to just hold that? You know, hold those difficult emotions, hold those difficult situations, the situations that maybe make us look at ourselves in ways that we don't want to see ourselves, and just like playing around with the potential for the power in that work. And how it connects, I guess, musically, coming back to this concept. And I feel like this has been coming up so much in the last several years. We think about the political climate that we're in today. We think about the Me Too movement, and we can come back to thinking about Bach and Beethoven, and it would be really, it feels like it would be easy. Some people say the ideal situation would be just to like put all the bad things on an island and like they just live by themselves. We never talk about them or think about them. But in some way, I feel like we miss the opportunity for the conversation and how we got there to those difficult places within us and to the difficult state that we're in. We just say, no, we're not dealing with that. We're not interacting with this. So, yeah.
So, we just offer a prompt. If the prompt works, great. And if the prompt isn't landing with something immediately, feel free to be flexible with this prompt. But can I ask you to turn to a neighbor, giving away some of the good material? That slide isn't on there for some reason, but I'll just say it out loud. So just turn to a neighbor, take just a few minutes on this, and where do you see coexisting narratives in your work that might not be in obvious agreement, but that are coexisting? Make sense? Where are coexisting narratives that are in conversation with each other that might be in disagreement? So yeah, and we'll maybe come back in 4 minutes, so just think about 2 minutes for me. What does that mean? Yeah, in your work, what two ideas that are both important but that might not go well together? Does everyone have a take one more minute to put them back together?
Sometimes when you have a community, there are certain things that a community can't provide. So a lot of this work that I'll just be sharing a bit of with you about comes from just my own personal relationship to practice and to being able to just show up in spaces and with my art. I thought that we would just start this session just with a 3-minute breathing pause. If everybody's comfortable with that, just settle into our spaces for a moment. And this is a practice that I take advantage of on a pretty much daily basis, sometimes moment to moment. And so if you just find just a comfortable seating seat that feels good for you, if you feel okay, you can just put your hands on your belly. And just take a second and just do a quick body scan. Feel free to close your eyes if that feels comfortable in the space. If it doesn't, that's okay. You can gaze lower or keep your eyes open. And we're just checking, just starting at the top of our head, and just notice any tension that we may feel there, any resistance, even any resistance to my voice or resistance to being in the space. Just see if we can let go a little bit of that tension, maybe breathe into it a bit. Notice the area around our eyes. onto our shoulders, our arms. Feel the space in our chest. There's anything to let go of there. Our bellies. Our hips. Our thighs. Our knees. Our calves. Maybe slowly let your eyes open and take your time to come back. So that's, I'll just say that all that I'll just be sharing, this work that I'm doing this year as a network fellow is anti-racism practices through self-love work. And the reason that I came into this work is really just based on my relationship to just being the person that I am as I walk through space and through this world and in this country. And as a classical musician, which I have been since I was 10 years old, I've been playing the viola, I always struggled just sort of showing up with my instrument in certain spaces, especially playing classical music, mostly white spaces. And I always sort of took a lot of responsibility and self-blame on why I was having such a hard time showing up in the spaces and being able to share and express through my instrument, which is kind of like a really big part of playing music, is that you have to eventually play it for other people if you're doing it professionally. And so it took me just so many years of just time with various levels of depression and anxiety and performance anxiety, which led to a lot of tension and stress in my playing, I'm just working through and searching on the search for just practices and ways to just show up. And music has been such a gift for me because it really just was a space to practice that just gave me an opportunity to be all the things that the ways that I need to just practice being in the world. I mean, when I don't play music, I'm also still anxious and just struggling to sort of show up and take up space which I appreciated us doing together when we first started. So coming to the Meeting Music Works, I was just really overwhelmed with such a really amazing community of people that really were so passionate about their work and their music making and the students that we spent so much wonderful time with, and it's the passion that that came from Sebastian's idea after graduating from college. And I felt like for the first time in my life that I had a space to really like, that was saying, actually we want you to show up and play music, we also want you to show up in all the other ways, we want your whole self to show up in this space and be here and interact with the students with your whole self and play music with us with your whole self. And it was a little overwhelming and I didn't really know what to do with it. And a part of that gift was just being able to become aware of all the resistance and hesitation that came up with actually being okay with showing up in those spaces. Because after, as I'm sure all of us have experiences with in various degrees, you know, that internalized relationship that we have to ourselves and how much space we can take up and how okay is it for us to be in a space and how much presence should we have, when you just hear it and somebody's telling you that, it's still a little hard to believe it and to feel like it's safe. You know, it's like, are you sure it's okay? So with that, and all of the practices that I just sort of attained over the years through meditation and yoga and lots of different readings from different spiritual teachers and references, I thought about the students that I, beautiful students that I got to interact with every day, all of the students, but particularly the black and brown students, and I thought about like what tools would have really benefited me growing up, and would have really like transformed the way that I saw myself and interacted with spaces and showed up playing music, but I had to sort of learn much later out of necessity. And so I formulated like a curriculum that I got to share last year. It was like a 6-week course that just incorporated some of these tools that I picked up on and some of these practices and some of these conversations that I feel like that took me many, many years to have with myself and with others. So I'm just gonna just share a little bit about that with you, and then I thought we'd just do a few practices to get together if it's okay. Sure. Oh, so I'll say that, sorry. So the position that I have this year is, as a network fellow, is a position where I get to sort of, the network is it's a group of organizations, youth arts organizations that sort of surround CMW, that is based on a Mellon grant, and it's sort of cohorts of musicians and educators that are just working towards just doing things differently and making a significant change in all of our lives, communities, and families. And so my job this year is to sort of get to share these practices with different organizations. So I'll be going around different organizations in New England, and there's one in Cincinnati, and one in Canada. I'll just share with the different students, along with the Music Works students, some of these practices. So it'll be in like different workshops. Some will be like 3-week residencies. Other times it'll be more like once a week over 6 weeks, or some that are closer together. So yeah, I don't know if there's anything you want to talk about. Yes, so I'll be doing that this year. So this class that I came up with, I called it The Love Within. I got the title from one of my favorite albums by Outkast, Love Below. Everybody knows that album, it's a great album. And it was just this concept of that came out of the practice of like, what does that feel like to start the practice of loving within? And how does that change the way that we're sort of grasping and searching for so much like love and attention and like reification of ourselves outside? And so one experience that I had, I'll do a practice of is this one big concert I had at the end of my string quartet fellowship at Community Music Works. I was having like heart palpitations, and for like 6 weeks before this concert, and I couldn't get my heart to stop racing. And I was having trouble sleeping, and I knew that I was just really just concerned about it. And so I was just doing my normal meditation practice, And something kind of in the practice just told me just kind of put my hand on my heart. It was like just a gesture that just came. My hand just kind of did it. And it just came out, I love you. Like this just came out and I kind of immediately after that, I heard that, I just started bawling. And it was like a really special experience that I, that occurred. And then I was okay. You know, my heart calmed down and I was able to sort of show up in that space. And it's something, a practice that I've just been doing ever since. And it seems like such a simple and easy thing, but it was just a really impactful experience for me. So I thought we could just maybe just try that together, and that feels okay for me for just going all over the place. But it feels comfortable, everybody feels okay doing that. We can just put your hand, one or two hands on your heart, and just sit comfortably, and you can close your eyes, and that makes it feel sort of easier for you to just be with yourself. And we just take 30 seconds, and let's say 20 seconds, and then just say, repeat that to yourself if that feels comfortable. So that's one of the practices that I sort of thought to share with our students, and that's one of the things that we did in this module. And I'll just quickly just read like the little goals that I had for this period. So it was to address the fears and insecurities that impact all aspects of the students' lives, including how they manifest with their instruments. The hope is to give students tools they can use daily. In worry-filled moments, along with giving them opportunities during our time together to break through common mind patterns. So that was the goal. And so some of the topics that we covered was the experience of worry and fear in our bodies. So I'm sure all of us as different, like varying degrees of artistry know, you know, that's something that we as humans interact with, you know, like mind, body, it's one. But just definitely thinking about how that really makes it really difficult to play an instrument or create, and to be vocal to something that takes so much level, so much vulnerability. So we spent a lot of time just talking about posture and playing while breathing, and interacting with like how maybe just to interact with those moments of worry and fear that manifest in our bodies. And breath has been a big part of that for me. But one of the special things about having conversations with amazing kids, all kids are so amazing, is that they just have so many ideas. Once you ask them, like, well, what do you think would be a great way for you to be okay, you know, and to work on this worry and fear in our bodies. And it's such an interesting thing, you know, like, to hear this idea of, like, oh, maybe I just need to, you know, close my eyes for a few seconds, or maybe I need to think about my mom, you know, or think about, like, how much I really love playing the violin. And it was just such a gift to just have that experience, to have that space, to have those conversations with the students. We also spent some time on a balance board, which was a lot more fun than I anticipated it being for some of the students. But it's something that I found really helpful to just notice, like what ways our system tilts, and especially when we're dealing with an instrument that sometimes doesn't feel as natural and ergonomic, we can make it more challenging than it needs to be by twisting and shaping our bodies in certain ways. And the kids had a lot of fun with that. So that was one of the topics, is worry and fear in our bodies. We had a section on taming the mind and self-talk. And so there was just just spending time with, you know, our relationship to the mind and thinking, and how that can be just such a violent and torrential place for all of us. And just some practices, we did some visualization and some affirmations on just different ways to combat those that language that we are all working with all the time. And with that, out of that came this the talk of perfection and making mistakes. So as all of us know, that just we all want to do things really well, and that's that's something that I feel like, yeah, that's a craving that we all have. But definitely, in our society in particular, there's something about the concept of getting it right. And when we play classical music specifically, it's this very specific, very detailed thing, and there are certain ideas on what is right and what is not right. And so as classical musicians, we have this practice of like working with that as artists ourselves in our relationships and getting it right and getting it wrong, and what does that mean, and also just imprinting that on our students, and how are we in a learning space where it is okay to make mistakes and just to explore, because I think personally there's in this realm of obsession of getting it right, it gets really hard to feel okay to explore. And that's where there's where the pith is so often. And if we think about, as we think about being an artist and the vulnerability that takes, we kind of have to push the sort of like level of infallible. Sebastian and I were having this conversation, like that work of just being infallible kind of gets in the way of that vulnerability. So we had spent some time with this concept of how do we practice. Just devoting our time to something and really caring about it, but being patient with the process and the space and it's going to look differently. And our learning process is going to look so differently from person to person, from student to student, and just wanting to create that space and just acknowledging like that in with words and in conversation with the students. So we spent a little time with that, and one of the practices that I did with that was sharing this concept of thinking of ourselves as a baby. So maybe I can, I'll just share a little picture with you all. So this is me as a baby. This practice came out of something else that just came a very powerful tool for me. I carry this picture around in my viola case. And It was just something that really helped me to just have some compassion and to just see myself from the beginning and that little person that's still inside of me, especially when I get worried and scared and just want to be loved and held. And so it was really funny because I shared this with our little class, and I was leading this session with another colleague of ours, Jesse. Who was a white male, and I passed the picture around. And I was like, they're like, I was like, do you guys know who that is? And they're like, well, it's not Jesse. And then yes, of course, it's. I think it looks a lot like me, but I thought maybe we could just spend a moment, if that's okay, and maybe just we're just gonna do a little visualization practice of just imagining ourselves as a little baby. If that's all right, and I find this practice to be just especially special for personally, and also just interacting in space with others, because there's like a little person like this that's just like really in all of us, you know, that doesn't go away once like the expectations of adulthood and just societal pressures, we're just this. So maybe we can just take a second, and if you want to just get comfortable, you can put your books down. We'll just take a minute or so to do this. And if you feel comfortable, you can close your eyes. And if it feels okay, feel free to put a hand on a heart or just hold your hands in your lap, whatever feels good. So I just encourage everybody just to envision yourself as a baby, if you can. Maybe just see that little baby, just like so new to the world, just got here, just arrived, and just full of like curiosity and like confusion and just wonderment. And we just imagined that little baby as they're just figuring things out and knowing how much they know, you know, they just got here, and how much compassion we would have to that little baby as they were just learning. They're learning to use their hands and their feet, and they're learning they're learning to lift up their head, and just how much patience we can have for that little baby just figuring out how to exist in their bodies. that maybe that little baby makes mistakes with that. Maybe they spill juice sometimes. Maybe they get applesauce all over their face and their clothes. And like how much can we just like just feel all that love and like understanding that that we have towards that little baby. Just a second, just kind of feeling that. Maybe we'll just pivot to ourselves now. And just see ourselves just figuring things out, filled with questions and concerns and worry, just wanting to feel safe. And at times, our person that makes mistakes, gets it wrong and fumbles. And can we just take some of that compassion that we just had for our baby versions and how much of that can we just hold on to and apply to our adult selves, ourselves now, our big selves. Extend that out into broader, into this state that we're in, maybe into this country, and to see all the people just trying to figure it out. Lastly, just a lot of people, we can just expand it out to our world as best we can. And just see all the little selves just doing, just working, just trying, and sensing compassion. And take your time to just come out of that, do that as long as possible. The last thing I'll just say, sort of going around, is for this year I just chose a few topics to share, I'll just sort of spew out a few of them. So one of them was this concept of body, breath, and space. So that was just this idea of, like I've just been said a few times, is just this concept of moving in a space together. And I think, for so long, that's a very free thing to feel, to be able to take up space and to be able to move freely in a space, especially with others. But sometimes, personally, even alone, to move freely without like instruction or direction, and also just feeling like we are free to take up space, and that not only are we free, but we have a right just as just humans that exist. To be in a space and to take up space. So that's just something that I want to share with the students, is just this ability to not only just be in our bodies, which sometimes is something that I have struggled with throughout my life, of just practicing to just come in my body and not be out, hang out up here in my mind, or just be out with the perception of others and what else I should be doing, but really just working on being in here and feeling what's happening. And one of the ways that I've that's helped me do that is just moving, and just moving freely in a space. And music is such an amazing gift to be able to do that with. And so that's just been a powerful tool for me, and I found that students seem to enjoy it too, and there's some people that just really love, that's like, yeah, let's just move into space together and put some tunes on. And then with that, feeling the aliveness of our body, it feels like, again, it's like, oh, okay, like this is it. Like I'm just here alive in my body. And I could be out here with all of the oppressive messaging that I'm receiving, and I'm gonna continue to deal with that and work with that, but also I'm here and I'm alive. And that's like totally valid and okay for me to be here. It's more than okay. So that's a big, it's just something that I think is just really important to share. And the breath, along with that, is just that one thing that the indicator of us being alive. Because when our breath finishes, then we leave this body. And just thinking about the power of being able to return to the body and return to the breath. And it's just a complete ability to transform like our relationship to our system, to calm it, to soothe it, and to just, and sometimes to re-energize it in a way that we can just be in space. So that's body, breath, and space is one of the areas. The other is the power of story, an accurate depiction of history. So I think it's often with my relationships, again with playing viola, it took me a long time to figure out where my voice was in the composers that I played for so many years, and thinking about like, yes, I can feel this music, and I can, you know, really just like, I believe it, you know, at times, but where am I, you know, in relationship to these performances and this expression when I'm playing this music from mostly no longer living composers. So this power story of thinking about like how can we have space to not only tell our stories, but also just tell each other's stories in a way. So if we think about like our students, most of our students' stories don't connect to an old, dead, white, a composer from Germany. But they have their own stories. They're really strong and powerful stories that do connect to the humanity of those composers. And I think just making the space to just think about like how we're just how just making the space to tell their stories through words, but also through music. Just feels like a really important thing. And when I think about the history, that was a huge thing for me growing up, was just, if you don't see yourself, creating in a certain way and expressing in a certain way, it's really hard to believe that you can actually do that and that it's okay to do that. And so that's been a big part of my journey is sort of working to make that okay. And I think it's helpful at times to think about like what are the stories that we don't know? What are the powerful people that we just haven't learned about? And I was having this conversation as recently, we're just talking about like just so many like really just the terrible atrocities that have happened throughout our history, that so much power and amazing work and like just like almost superhuman things have come out of so much pain. And it's just even hard to imagine, like, if you think of like the Holocaust or slavery and just like just people that were able to save so many lives, to not only just survive but to thrive out of those terrible situations. And that's something that I think is not always, not only is that not depicted in usually in history books and in our education, our formal education, but it's also not something that we're reminded of, is like those powerful stories of like just the amazing work that came out of the most awful things that happened to human beings. And and just thinking about like how does that feel to be a part of that lineage? Yes, we're a part of the lineage of people that have been oppressed for so long, but we're also a part of just people that have done so much out of that oppression, in spite of that oppression. And so so that's something that I just want to just another just passion to share with with the students in relation to their music, just as their as far as their humanhood goes, their personhood. And I'll just tell a quick share. I recently went to this performance, this dance performance in New York City by this amazing Nigerian dancer musician named Nora Chikomire. And I had never been to a performance of hers before. And it was transformative. And it was just this really impactful performance about her relationship to being a Nigerian woman and being an artist and being in different societies and moving throughout the world and sharing her art. And it was so bold and beautiful, and also like there's so much rage in it. And it was so unapologetically fully her. And for me, at 31 years old, that like changed me, you know, to just watch that. And what I thought was, man, like what if I experienced a performance like that, an expression like that, like every week of my childhood? And like how again would that have like transformed the way that I walk through spaces and just am, you know, and like the pride that I would feel. And that's something that I feel like it's almost like this concept of not even just an accurate depiction of history, but it's like a little bit of a rewriting, because those people do exist and they have existed. And now there's so much amazing work that's happening today, you know, and just thinking about just finding that and sharing that. And there's so much there. So just wanted to share that. And the last thing that I'll say is just, I think as artists, is this concept of identity and its relationship to our craft and creative outlets, and just the practice of, again, if we think about not only just getting it right, but like our relationship to like a certain level of success in our craft and in our, and sometimes our identity and our self-value can get really entwined with the work that we do. And how well we think we're doing it, or society perceives how well we're doing it, and just thinking again how we can so like unintentionally pass that on to our students, and just thinking about my own practice with that, again of coming back to self-worth and value, where it doesn't have to be about like, you know, if I got a note wrong in that performance, you know, or I missed an entrance, or my hand was shaking a little bit, you know, and like just thinking about how my personhood is not so caught up in how well I perceive and others may perceive that I'm doing things. And it has nothing to do with how well we want to do things, because it's so disconnected from like the passion to do things just well and with our whole selves and fully vulnerable, with all the vulnerability that we can, but just not letting that sort of like crush our relationship to ourselves and our value that we have that's so separate from that. I just wanted to share that with students. So I think I'll end with that. But thank you all. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you for sharing.
So this is the point where we just want to open it up. During the time you shared with a partner earlier, there might have been things that you wanted to share with the whole group, but we intentionally moved on just to with this afternoon, but if there's anything that came up in terms of those conflicting narratives that you might want to bring to the group, or questions for Ashley, or questions for me, or other things that just come up, so
I have a question.
Sure.
I think it's for you, Ashley, though. So you've talked about fear, you've talked about anxiety, and you've talked about the importance of self-love. And you also gave one particular example you gave from your own childhood of the blame you put on yourself, the challenges you had to expression. And I'm curious about, it's an emotion that you haven't mentioned, which is shame. And I'm wondering, have you encountered that in the work that you just described to us? And if so, and in the young, either in yourself, it's very thing to share, or in the students that you're working with, and how have you met shame?
I guess I'll say just start just a personal relationship to that and how that carries it out. Yeah. is really just connects a lot to that, the practice of when we don't get it right, you know, or when I, you know, when I feel like I fall short and have struggled, and I think even if whatever's going on as far as like a present practice, it can be really easy to hold on to all those moments where one was just really dissatisfied with our output or our actions, and so I'll just say personally with my relationship to that, my meditation practice has just been something that's just really helped me a lot with just sitting with that, and when that does come up, because it does come up often, sometimes alongside that fear, because so there can be shame around being scared and shame around worrying or not feeling confident, comfortable in a space. So that's just been a big thing for me. And another part of that would be this, the relationship to the breath and where that sits in the body when shame is arising. And just feeling how it constricts and just gets small. And so just the allowing of the opening up of that has been something that I work on, and I just try to share that when I see that in my students. I've had moments with, my female students of color, where they tend to like apologize a lot when they make a mistake, and I do that too. So not only was I just sort of aware and watching like my habits that they had, but I'm also just like helping them continue to have that by having a habit of doing that. But also in the space, like how I reacted to their saying sorry, and not just like either. Sometimes I felt like I would want to just dismiss it because I would want it. I just like no, you know, don't apologize. But even being like, actually, you know, like we're just gonna sit here for a second and just let's just not worry about because we say sorry as soon as we make a mistake. Usually, for me, there's a relationship to forgetting about. We miss what we actually need to do to make it better. You know, to fix it. You know, so then we usually just have this practice of like, okay, like. Right in that moment where something happened, let's even just go, you know, and let's address it, you know, let's just like be there with that, and that apology is so not necessary because this is what we're here for, is to be here with this, and so I find myself often just working with that breath, and especially coming back to the instrument after a mistake and apology, and seeing like certain postures and gestures that may come that exhibit shame, so I don't know if that answers your question, but I. Yeah, that's. I feel like that's just really valuable and a big part of just growth and transformation. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Amy, would you like to? Just go like this, maybe.
Sure. I feel like what I have to say is it's part gushing appreciation of CMW as a parent who has a child at CMW, and it's part also what this conversation is giving me in terms of insight about the role of being artists or cultural workers in relation to this question about the counterpoint, like the dual narratives or the multiple narratives. As a parent. You know, I feel like there are those counterpoint narratives that run through the household. You know, as I have this child that I'm bringing into the world, and I want him to already be living in the world like you were saying, Maxine Green said, like how we would want to see it otherwise. And yet, all the narratives run through the household that come from the economic system, and you know, ways that adults are oppressive to young people, and our feelings about work, and school that he goes to, and you know, all the oppressive culture is always telling its story, even in our most intimate spaces. And one of the things that I feel like myself and my partner try to do as parents is find those little moments where the story can be different. And one of the ways that, you know, you talk about how CMW, the ecosystem of the students and the teachers and the fellows and the artists, and the parents aren't there. You know, we're at home sending our kids off to CMW, assume that what you're doing by creating this model of the world as it should be is you're creating that narrative that flows back into our house. So Julian has this experience in our house of the different ways that he has to encounter the world as it is according to dominant culture, and then the ways that he encounters the world, not just that we're providing, but that you all are providing in this world that you've created. So it's deeply supportive to us as parents, even though we're not there most of the time. So I wanted to put that out, and also that as artists and cultural workers, we're creating a counterpoint all the time. And it just ripples out so far beyond the people that we're even individually working with. We're putting these stories out into the world that just keep going. And I just really love that. And the other thing I wanted to say that I think is so significant about the work is, you know, Julian's in the Daily Orchestra program, which meets every day. And they're going to keep, this one group is going to keep meeting together. They started when they were six. And this one group is going to meet together all the way through their senior high school, their community, their family. And to me, what that says is something that it contradicts this message that young people get all the time, that their relationships are always changing. They always have new friends. They always have new teachers. They're taken out of this relationship and put into this relationship. They don't have agency over it, right? But at CMW, just that structure says your relationships matter and you get to keep them. And that's really powerful. That's like another one of those stories that now can run through our house in his life. So thank you.
I have just a couple of quick observations and then a question. So as a black woman, what I appreciate about this way that you're working with black and brown students is that I think that it attends to the harm of internalized oppression and internalized racism, and that really does remove the barrier and creates more access to the music, to the instrument. And so I really appreciate that, and I think that that is I think that that's a strategy and a tool that's underused when working with kids, students of color around music, access to the arts or whatever, is the role of how internalized racism or internalized oppression creates the internal barriers. It's not the child's fault, which also is something that we internalize as people of color, is that we've brought this on ourselves because we're inherently flawed. So I appreciate that. The other thing is that I think also is that what you're doing is an antidote to white supremacy culture, this idea of perfection, that there's only one way of doing it, that there's only one way of understanding it. And I also appreciate that you're very intentional. Well, you may not. I see it that way as a black woman, that this is one of those antidotes to this, what is the dominant culture norm about how we think about where music has to be and who gets to play it and how it gets to be played and that kind of thing. So I really appreciate that. So my question is, to that point about white supremacy culture, what do the other music educators go through in terms of training about anti-racism or anti-oppression? And is there a training that the staff goes through that understands this larger political context in which you're offering this program?
The short answer is there's no one training that we do. But I, you know, alluded in my comments to sort of taking a deeper level of inquiry over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
So what that has led to is some really beautiful work. Ashley's position is part of this network, and another part of this network is a week-long summer institute, which has but the first one revealed the need for a lot more deep training, especially for the white teachers. And if we're really talking about anti-racist practice on the organizational level, on the repertoire level, and on the pedagogy level, there's a lot of learning, especially from the white folks that used to get to Sixth Avenue. So I mentioned to you after lunch that I had done the People's Institute training this spring, but we're lucky that our city Department of Art, Culture, and Tourism is actually bringing People's Institute to Providence on an annual basis. So this year will be an opportunity for more of our staff and educators to go through that. But also we just invited some folks whose work and training we really admire and respect to the Summer Institute to do some trainings right there, both for our teachers, but also for teachers from around this network of 10 organizations. I think your question's a really timely one in our work. I think we're identifying the need more than that we've crossed over to knowing that they have accomplished it. And then, you know, like we referenced earlier, just the headwind of Casa, because new teachers come in, and teachers have been there a long time. Still, they were all trained in a particular way, in a particular system. And one of our board colleagues who's leading some work around equity and social justice in the organization brought in this phrase that's quite familiar to some of you, that when you're relying on another system that's inherently unjust for some of your goods, that's really hard to make your system align with your values. So the classical music training field, conservatories, higher ed institutions, there's so little discourse about equity, freedom, emancipatory pedagogy, the kind of things that we're trying to value. So then it's like, well, maybe someone is predisposed and has gone out and sought some of this training or thinking or self-practice before they come to us, great. And if not, and they're highly trained and have a lot of skills and passion and commitment, but they don't know what they don't know, that's like a lot. It's a lot of work. And so, and part of our model is to have new fellows come in every year. So we're really wrestling with that, how to practice something that we can say, well, actually within an organization that's primarily focused on classical music, although in terms of the repertoire, we go beyond what we call strictly classical music. There's a lot of steps.
Is there time? I feel like we're slowing down.
We're 2 minutes past, but maybe folks are okay. We'll take one last question.
My comment is actually my comment. The question is big. The thumbnail of this is I have a 16-year-old daughter. She's queer, and the day. As a parent, want to define the resolution. We're talking about counting. For me as a community worker or a community cultural worker, I'm a composer too. I'm very aware of counterpoint. I'm aware of counterpoint. You know, we step into places where there's real conflict and historic trauma. And in some cases, things are not resolved. Answer my daughter about some of these questions. I feel a certain responsibility to resolve the counterpoints of dissonance. And I'm just curious, just you know, in terms of how it is that you are people who are working in the medium of counterpoint. How do you find those moments of celebration in the midst of a time when it was finished to do this?
I guess I'll just say briefly that I think, just personally, I get so much out of just spending time with the students, you know, and being able to have conversations. And sometimes they're the ones that bring the joy, you know, and the hope. But I feel like there's like always this practice of working on that in the space. And I had I think, yeah, there's something about like moments of, like I was just thinking about the Kavanaugh hearings that just came up, and I led a teen discussion that week, and it was supposed to be, actually supposed to be really just based on these practices and just sharing some tools and techniques. And then I felt like, oh, we just need to just spend time with this and just be in the space with this large, really difficult thing to take in. And we had this conversation, and you know, we always put this is practice has been cultivated. I don't know how long phase two has been happening. 15 years or so of like just a history of the older students who are coming into a community of. With their peers and just having social justice conversations, social justice based conversations, and so we had this conversation, and I was having a hard time, and I felt like I just wanted to get across how much I just really loved the students, and just I wanted them to feel like really cared for and respected, and that if anything had ever happened to them, that they would be listened to. And believed, and there was something that nothing got fixed, you know, in that moment, in that hour when we got to have that conversation together. But it was really powerful for all of us in the space, especially for me, to just be in the space and just to just be able to say that in the space and just express our care for each other and just to listen to our perspectives and opinions. And like work through and see all of us like working through our like understanding of what is happening. And the difficulty with that. And so I'll just say that is like, that there's a lot of moments like that that I've had with individual students where I can only just appreciate the space and hope that that's a really impactful thing for them to have that space too. And that like that, so many kids having that space will contribute to something, to something really.
Do you guys share your programming information? Like your specifically what you developed for the Summer Institute?
Yeah, I can, and I'll be doing the different things this year that I'll be just sort of documenting in different ways, and I'm happy to like sure we can figure out a way to just like just share that. Yeah, for sure. So maybe if I see that some of us have to go and we're a little over time, if we're okay with just doing a one final little way of ending this time together, is that okay with everyone? Maybe we can all just stand up in a circle. And we're gonna get kind of a shoulder to shoulder, each other, if that's okay. And that was the sets of our, everybody's gonna just put their hand, their right hand on their heart. And then we're going to take our left hand and put it on the back of the heart of the person to our left. And if you're comfortable, you can just close your eyes. We're just going to rest here for a second and just feel our hearts. And we're just going to take three deep breaths together in this space.
No.
Ashley, that is ridiculously cute.